welcome back to Random Trek, the podcast in which I, your host, Scott McNulty, discuss a random episode of Star Trek with a non-random guest. I am joined today by Grant Oatsky, who I don't want to say that some guests are more random than others, but I I only know of Grant because he wrote a very funny McSweeney piece that I will link to. And so I sent him an email saying, would you like to be on Random Trek? And he said yes. And here he is. Thank you, Grant, for joining me.
Thank you for allowing some major randomness on your podcast.
Well, it's a core tenet of my podcast is the randomness. So I try. Before we started recording, we were talking about John Syracuse a little bit, and when he was on, one of the times he questioned the randomness because he was like, "I'm not random," and I was like, "Well, you are kind of random." But anyway.
Well, I think the Venn diagram between Apple and Star Trek has a big intersection, a big bit in the middle overlapping.
I think that's true. Certainly, I'm in that intersection. Although I will say I'm a certain age where I am a Gen Xer. So when I didn't have a computer until I graduated from college, actually. So I loved Star Trek long before I loved Apple products, is my point here, which is interesting. And that's a good segue to ask you, do you consider yourself a Star Trek fan?
I do. And I probably at one point super obsessed with Star Trek. My Star Trek is Star Trek The Next Generation.
Oh, right. That's the right answer.
I'm probably, a similar generation to you. Mm-hmm. So that was the one I grew up with. And it's probably like shaped a whole lot of my life, right? Just the characters on there are like second parents, foster parents in some ways to me. So
yes.
Yeah, I definitely am a Star Trek fan.
I was thinking about that as I was reading Patrick Stewart recently published his memoir, Making It So, which I read only because he's Patrick Stewart and he's my space father. It's a celebrity memoir. It's fine. But it made me think about this kind of weird relationship. It is really one-sided, obviously, that I have with Patrick Stewart and the rest of these Star Trek characters, right? Like, they don't know who I am. They shouldn't. And the characters obviously don't exist. But it's just an interesting, like, how strong a relationship I feel to these characters.
I totally get that. Like, you know, in that situation, Picard makes this decision. Mm-hmm. And so maybe I should do that, too.
Yes.
Like, this kind of guidance there, I think.
And get further along in my career and have to, get the opportunity to manage people, you think about like what Star Trek captain would you want to be thought of, or who do you emulate? And I'm not sure Captain Picard is really the best person to emulate on the management side, because he's kind of a little standoffish, a bit closed off.
I might veer towards Janeway or somebody like that. Yeah,
I feel like Janeway is the one. If you want to work for someone, you want to work for Captain Janeway, because she will care about you and talk to you.
And there'll always be coffee around.
That's right. She will find the coffee.
Yeah,
you probably don't want to work for Ben Sisko. Although I love Ben Sisko as a character, but. I don't think
In this episode, there's a sort of signs of what it would be like to work under Ben Sisko, especially the younger one.
Yeah, another perfect segue. Grant, you're a pro with this. So the episode we're talking about, although I did skip one thing we delve into the episode, I will have ask you to tell people about yourself, but I will tell people now, although you already know because you downloaded this podcast, the episode we're talking about is a Deep Space Nine episode, season 7 Deep Space Nine episode, which always gets a little sticky for a random podcast because season 7 is a pretty heavily arced season. Although this episode can stand alone by itself. The Siege of AR-558, which is season 7, episode 8, which is part of an arc, but it's a pretty standalone episode as well. Now, before we delve into this episode, which there's a lot to talk about, I think. First, let's talk about you, Grant. What's your story?
My story is I'm calling from Wellington, New Zealand,
ooh,
which I have a feeling it might be the furthest guest you've ever had on your podcast.
I think that is true.
Yeah. But you might tell from my accent that I'm not from New Zealand. I actually grew up in Canada. So I was watching Star Trek on when you subscribe to basic cable, you get some American channels in Canada. So I was watching Star Trek The Next Generation and reruns on ABC. I'm down in Wellington working at a university. I teach cultural anthropology at a place called Victoria University of Wellington. And so I do research on and teaching on anthropology. I've been here about 6 years. And I like to study things like technology and culture and machines' relationship to humanity. And I also do a bit of work on Japan. So all of those things sort of come together in a bunch of different things that I've been looking into, projects. But you might also guess that probably that direction in life was shaped a little bit by being obsessed with Star Trek early on.
I do sometimes wonder how much of society we owe to Star Trek, both good and bad. Speaking of which, I can't have a cultural anthropologist on at this moment in time and certainly if you're interested in technology and not just ask you about generative AI and what you think about it. Is it going to solve all of our problems or become our robot overlord and destroy us? Those are the only two options, by the way.
Those are the only two options. Yes. Those are the only two options. Well, I have only two answers then, which is maybe and I don't know. I actually use it a lot in my day to day because, you know, you end up working with a lot of data and then so you go to Excel, but then you can't quite remember the formulas. Mm-hmm. You ask ChatGPT what the formula is. But I was also chatting with a friend just like yesterday and they used it to guess my horoscope sign on the first try, which was kind of eerie.
Ooh, that is weird.
So it really, yeah, it's helpful for Excel and then a bit creepy for knowing people, but it seems to be getting better at that. So I think I like it. We'll see how it goes, but I hope whoever's making it, they're the right people and they've watched the right science fiction to help them guide them in the right direction.
That's right. Hopefully they are not fans of Terminator, but rather fans of Star Trek, I think.
Although you hear a lot of Terminator references when people talk about AI, right?
Mm-hmm. It is true. That is worrisome. And I will say, I think it's, I have this poster framed in my the room that I am in at this very moment that says fire good but also bad.
I would probably say the same thing about AI. Mm-hmm. AI good but also bad.
Exactly. So it's all about how you use it. And people are awful. Let's just agree on that. So it's going to be people are going to misuse it, but also do wonderful things. People are also wonderful.
Yeah, they can be noble and then they have deep, deep dark sides, right?
Exactly. And that is a huge theme that Star Trek deals with. And generally, one of the things that attracts me to Star Trek is the optimism that we find in Star Trek, right? Where it's the future. We've figured out how to end wars. Everyone agrees on Earth, seemingly, although we never really see much of Earth. So there's, you know, one government, which some people find, not great, but other people think would be a great idea. There's no poverty. Everybody's happy, theoretically. And that's kind of generally, you know, post-scarcity society. That's where, and they're all working together. The biggest thing, they're working together.
That's the next generation vision of human society, right?
And then Deep Space Nine comes along and says, what if everything's not as rosy as it was on that beige Enterprise bridge?
Yeah. What's the cost of all of this?
Mm-hmm. And gives us a very interesting look at kind of, I think, the non-Federation alien characters in Deep Space Nine.
Yeah.
Play a huge role in making it as interesting and as great, frankly, a show as it is. And in this episode, in particular, while I think it is weird from if you're looking at this as like a reflection of reality that Quark is there because it seemingly doesn't make any sense for him. It makes sense for how they get him there. But then once they're like, oh, we're going to beam you out. And Sisko says, we're not beaming out Quark should have been beamed out.
let him go home first.
Exactly. But they keep him there because he is not, he's outside of the Starfleet, right? And Nog is there. So he plays this role of kind of like, hey, these humans are, you know, as long as you keep them fed and with their creature comforts, they're great. But once you take those things away, watch out.
Yeah. Well, that's a great line. Those are great lines that Quark gets.
Quark does great work in this episode, and this episode is, you know, if you had only up until this point, I don't know how you would have gotten to this, had only seen The Next Generation, and then this is the only Deep Space Nine episode you watch, you would think, this is Star Trek? This is not Star Trek, right? This is a very dark episode.
Well, the thing for me is, and I'm going to probably admit this to my peril on a Star Trek podcast, is that I actually hadn't watched much of Deep Space Nine properly. Because Deep Space Nine starts in like 97, right? A few years before that, maybe. But this episode, I was looking up on Memory Alpha, it airs in 98 in November. And I actually left Canada to go study in Japan for a few years at the beginning of 98. So I missed all of season 7, basically. And I think I'd sort of drifted away from Star Trek even before that. So I remember watching the pilot of Deep Space Nine, but not quite really following it through like season 5, 6-ish probably. And by season 7, I just didn't have access to it at all. So watching that this episode for this podcast is probably the first time I've watched this episode properly, you know, not having it like run in the background on Netflix while I'm doing something else. So it was like pretty fresh in a way, but also, you know, it's not the Star Trek I knew, but it is coming out of the Star Trek I knew, right?
Yes.
It's familiar characters, familiar species, but they've all gotten a depth that you never see in Next Generation, especially with like the Ferengi, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the Ferengi were just in Next Generation. They were like what had energy whips and were wearing weird fur outfits and could hardly
speak.
And
they're like all about money and in a society that has replicators. And they're all hunched over and just sort of like, you know, they're really, you know, a caricature of weird, crazy capitalist businessmen. I don't know what it is, but they're just about the money and about, you know, tricking people, essentially, right?
Basically.
But that's not what they are in Deep Space Nine.
Well, and that's what I love so much about Deep Space Nine. I mean, I will say, and people who've listened to this podcast before have heard this before, like, The Next Generation is my favorite Star Trek series. But I think Deep Space Nine is the best Star Trek series. And because they just kind of discovered this, Deep Space Nine didn't discover this, but this is the first Star Trek series that really did go into that kind of those arcs and, you know, something happens and then it has consequences later on. It's not kind of reset. And this episode is a great example of that because spoiler alerts, if you haven't watched the Siege of AR-558 and you're listening to this podcast for some reason and you are averse to spoilers, you stop listening because I'm about to say that Nog loses his leg, which is traumatic and is in, I mean, it wouldn't have happened in previous Star Trek series.
Yeah.
But they actually, like there's an episode later on, which is a really good episode where he deals with kind of the post-traumatic stress of losing your leg and trying to figure out how he can deal with this. And so like the things that happen in these episodes have consequences for the characters that then make them richer characters.
Yeah, I went back and watched that episode too, right after watching this one. Mm-hmm. And the way that, you know, that first of all, you would never imagine if you were just watching Next Generation that a Ferengi character gets this much time, this much development, right? He really goes through everything in these two episodes from being like really idealistic and looking up to heroes into a place where he's like super conflicted, right, about what he's doing and how people are looking at him. And I think it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, I mean, as a two kind of a back-to-back episodes of Deep Space Nine, I would be hard-pressed to think of a better combination because they are really, certainly together, they're really good. I mean, on their own, they're also very good, but one gives context to the other and really helps. And I think that's a credit to the actor who plays Nog, whose name I am not remembering.
Aaron Eisenberg?
Yes. He does a great job of taking... I mean, I think Nog, season one, Deep Space Nine, Nog, is not season seven, Deep Space Nine, Nog. But you can see he's grown up and he's become a real character as opposed to, you know, Jake's little sidekick.
Well, isn't he in the very first episode of Deep Space Nine?
I think he is.
Nog?
And with
like he's,
Jake.
He's like robbing like an abandoned shop or something like that and gets caught by Odo.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think he says anything, but Nog shows up there as like this delinquent, and then gradually, I think it was Nog, gradually he becomes this like officer, and he becomes like a real three-dimensional character with conflicts and ideals and, you know, everything.
Mm-hmm. It's really good. And I think the same can be said for Quark, right? Quark is... you know, kind of he imagines himself the Ferengi's Ferengi, right? And throughout the seasons of Deep Space Nine, they really give him an incredible depth, and they continue. He still has this kind of like a surface of avarice and rules of acquisition and all of that, but underneath it, not even that deep. He really cares about these people, and he just he struggles with expressing it.
Well, I really actually like the three of them. So Nog and Rom and Quark mm-hmm. is like a set of three characters, really different characters, right? Like Quark is this sort of like very driven, but his motivations are most of the time really on the surface, but he has some under the surface complexity. Mm-hmm. Rom is sort of the exploited little brother, but he comes into his own mm-hmm. as he discovers his own aptitudes and finds a place as an engineer. Mm-hmm. And then there's Nog, who sort of takes a little bit of both of them, right? He has this tenacity, but he's also has this skill and aptitude that his father has. And between the three of them, you see like really diverse range of what Ferengi can be in this universe that they don't have when they first show up, and or even when they later show up in Next Generation in some of the later episodes, right? It's still like a sort of minor villain kind of species rather than a real presence in the universe, right?
Yeah, I think that's 100% correct. And it's interesting, and I think, you know, this touches on what I said earlier about kind of how Deep Space Nine uses the alien characters to show kind of the wider scope of the universe and make you think about what the Federation is doing and kind of maybe question a little bit about it. Because they do Deep Space Nine also really enriches the Klingons as well. And especially when Worf arrives, there's a lot more Klingon stuff happening, which I think...
And the Cardassians.
Oh, the Cardassians are great. And the Bajorans, yes, the whole Bajoran Cardassian thing. I mean, they are really, they take, I wouldn't say that the Next Generation was straightforward, but it was certainly just you take on an assumption that the Federation is doing the right thing and that Starfleet wants to do the right thing. And then Deep Space Nine is like, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, even at the very end of Next Generation, you get those hints where you have people who look at the Federation and are like, that's not the kind of life I want.
Mm-hmm.
I want something else. But Deep Space Nine like really goes into that. And then you see, you know, it just turns into war basically in the end, right?
That's true. And that leads us to this episode where basically our friends on Deep Space Nine jump into their ship, which they didn't have for many seasons, but then they have a ship now, the Defiant, and the war is raging, the war with the Dominion, and things are not going well for the Federation. I will say that, you know, I may not want to have Ben Sisko as my manager. But an actor, now why am I blanking on the name of the guy who plays
Avery
Brooks. Thank you. He is fantastic. And this episode gives him a lot of moments to just be sad, which is kind of, you know, minimizing it, but like there's this episode, the scene with Odo comes in and he's looking at the casualty list and just kind of, it's clear that he's not happy, but he is, it's his duty to try and, you know, get this war over with because it's important. And you know, there's a, Ben Sisko is an interesting character for many reasons, right? Because he's a Starfleet officer. He's like a religious figure to the Bajorans. And he's also, I think he has a strong moral compass, but he is not, he is willing to bend some of those things to get to the right point, right? So he would do things that Picard and Janeway wouldn't.
definitely. And he's also like an amazing father too.
Yes.
That's something I always remember about Benjamin Sisko. But what struck me about Sisko in this episode is just how little in some ways he says, but how much the whole situation is weighing on him. Like you can just see the weight of all of these deaths that he's, you know, reading the names of the people who've been killed in the war. He's having to make these really hard decisions about who to send out and to stay on the planet in the first place. And, you know, there's a moment where he kind of blows up at Quark, where you see that bubble over, but you can sort of feel the weight of all of this duty and responsibility on him for the entire episode, which I think was really, really impressive.
Yes, because, you know, you have to make, I mean, I've never been in this situation, but I assume when you're in such a situation, you have to make very difficult decisions. And I mean, Quark basically says that when Sisko sends Nog off to be, they beam to this outpost that has a Dominion communications relay that's basically like a bunch of caverns. It was unclear to me if they were underground or outside because they called them caverns. It doesn't really matter. But it was unclear. And so they're, you know, they're under siege, as the title may point out to you. And they are need to send a scouting party, right? And so they send Nog because the Dominion are doing something to screw up the tricorders, and Nog can hear the Jem'Hadar soldiers. And Quark basically says, "You wouldn't send Jake out to do this," to which Sisko replies, "Jake's not a Starfleet officer."
Yeah. Which feels a bit like a cop-out to me, doesn't it?
Yes, it is totally a cop-out. Because I think the he pauses, so I credit this to Avery Brooks, like there's a pause, like a pregnant pause, as they say. And then he says, Jake is not a Starfleet officer. So he doesn't actually answer. I mean, he answers the question, but he basically, you sense that he wouldn't send Jake to do these things. I mean,
but I want to go back to this communications array for a second.
Yes,
because you know, and this isn't it's a minor complaint, maybe about a really great episode.
I love minor complaints.
But if it feels like this communications array. So there's a communications array that the Dominion has lost, and this small group of really like a depleted force of Starfleet soldiers are trying to guard it, and the Dominion's trying to take it back, and they're attacking over and over months and months, like 5 months or something.
Yeah, they've been down there 5 months. They start with like 120 people and end up with 40 people or something like that.
Yeah, and I feel like, and they talk about this communications array like it's going to be something to change the course of the war. They're going to get access to all of Dominion communications if they figure this thing out, if they protect it and they're like able to decode it or something. But if it's so key, why not send like everybody to this one planet in order to guard this thing? And why aren't the Jem'Hadar sending like everybody on their side, knowing that this is like potentially a huge weakness, right? It's like, you know, giving up all the passwords to your Wi-Fi or something on the network. Why not send everybody there instead of having like even 100 or 150 to start out with, right? It just feels like a bit out of scale for the importance that they're placing on it.
No, I will agree that I thought this episode was very good, but I had the same exact problem with it because they put so much emphasis on how important this thing is. And I thought to myself, well, then why are you just keeping these people? Like, you should send more people to it. Certainly, yeah. You should send more engineers, since you only have one engineer that's apparently working on this. And it's Will Robinson from Lost in Space. So he dies at the end. Sorry. But it just seemed, it struck me as weird that they wouldn't have more engineers at the very least trying to figure out how to get into this thing. But a couple times, I think there's like a passing, like very quick scene where Cisco's like, you know, our resources are stretched, so we can't send anyone. Although you wonder, why didn't they bring Miles O'Brien with them? Because he would have gone there and he just would have figured it out in 2 seconds. So
He totally would have.
But he's back on Deep Space Nine. A lot of the characters don't show up in this episode. So we've got Cisco, we've got Noggin Quark, and we've got Julian Bashir on... Ezri Dax, I forgot. In the firefight there, and then on the ship there's Worf and is there anybody else? Is Kira? No, Kira's
O'Brien is on the ship.
Oh, O'Brien's on the ship, and Kira's back on Deep Space Nine, hanging out, waiting for doing whatever it is she's doing on Deep Space Nine with Odo.
Yeah. I think she shows up right at the end for like one scene or something.
Yes, she shows up at the last scene, and I think Odo shows up maybe the first, like in the stinger there, or the teaser, I should say. And there you go. Yeah, so basically they show up, they're under siege, they have some supplies, we meet a bunch of people who have been down there for 5 months, and it's getting to them. They are like, oh, great, thanks for bringing the supplies, I guess you're just going to leave now. And Cisco is basically like, yep, we're going to leave. Good luck. But then...
Yeah, you've got your orders.
Exactly. And then along come the Jem'Hadar, and Cisco is like... I think this episode is very well structured, because we spend some time with meeting these people, and they spend a lot of time... like when the away team beams down, they take fire and they think, oh no, the Jem'Hadar are shooting at us. But no, it's the Starfleet folks that you're here to help, because they're, nervous about the Jem'Hadar. The Jem'Hadar just kind of appear. And speaking of appearing, they have these things they call Houdini mines that are hiding in subspace and randomly appear. And and so it's a really tense situation for these people.
Yeah. I mean, I think the waiting of all of it is really, contributes so much to the tension, right? Like, when is this attack going to come? How many of them are going to come? Are we ready for it? How do we prepare for something like that? And just the tenseness of the waiting, gives an opportunity to meet some of these temporary characters, these guest stars. Mm-hmm. But it also is just, like, it's a very atmospheric episode, right?
Yes.
It's about living inside that tension and seeing how that breaks people.
Yeah, and a lot of Star Trek is kind of wide in scope, right? You've got these starship battles, or you're going to new alien planets, and this is very confined space, and it's very tense, and you're just waiting. Like, there are a lot of scenes where they're just, like, hiding behind rocks and waiting for the Jem'Hadar to show up. And in a kind of, I think, a really cool head fake, the first time the Jem'Hadar attack, they're holograms, and they're just there to kind of pull them out of their position so that they can come and really attack them. And I thought that was clever, and kind of adds to the tension and people freaking out. Although I did wonder if they have been there for 5 months and the Jem'Hadar have been attacking and attacking, why would this be the first time that they tried this hologram trick? But I guess there's a first time for everything. So,
yeah. Although I did wonder, if I were the Jem'Hadar, I would have sent the holograms in and sent the people in, and then just made it into like a look like a huge army or something like that. But I think there's a lot to complain about with the tactical decisions.
Yes, that's not the point of the episode.
Both sides make. But and it's the flip side of like, why doesn't Starfleet or why doesn't the Dominion just throw everything at this base in its defense or in its attack? And I think the flip side of that is it brings everything down to like a really human scale, right? You have a handful of people, you know, a dozen people that you see on screen at any one time. You have a few, you know, soldiers coming at them. And if you think about it as like a realistic depiction of a battle, it kind of doesn't make sense, especially if it's like a 24th century battle. But if you think about it, it's like this is like almost like a stage play, right? Mm-hmm. It's kind of like a stage play version of a massive battle where you don't see the whole battle, but you feel the atmosphere and you feel the fear that these characters are having, which everybody on the battlefield would be feeling. And so as sort of a narrative thing, I think it works really well, you know, even if it doesn't hit the realism button quite as strongly as it might otherwise. I mean, I think about, there's a similar episode in Strange New Worlds, I think from the last season, where you have Mbenga and Chapel trying to treat soldiers during a Klingon war. And that one, it's similarly tense. But the battle just looks a bit bigger. You know, all the newer Star Trek battles look massive. Mm-hmm. You have dozens and dozens of ships. And you don't have that in the earlier versions of Star Trek for a lot of reasons, but I think they do a really, really good job of bringing out that feeling in a way that's almost like a stage play.
Yeah, I agree. And I think they use one of the things that Star Trek has been known for a long time is kind of using their limited resources very well, right? And so they use that kind of claustrophobic sense of the small sets that they have to their advantage in this episode, right? Because that helps with the sense of confinement and tension, and yeah, like we're surrounded and we have to and that great scene where Sisko takes command and the veteran says, "What's your orders, Captain?" And he says, "Hold," and like that's all they have. The literally the only thing they can do is sit there and wait for the Jem'Hadar and try and, you know, rebuff the advance, and that's all. Like they can't leave, there's no place to hide. They can't abandon the relay because it's their job to make sure it doesn't fall into the Jem'Hadar's hands.
Yeah, which is a terrifying place to be.
Yes, not good. Especially since the Jem'Hadar are pretty good soldiers. And they attack, and we see a lot of people die, frankly. A bunch of characters die. Our friend Will Robinson dies. And there are a couple of scenes that, so he's talking to Ezri Dax, and they're bonding over engineering and have a nice conversation about, Dax, says that, you know, this is her first time in a combat situation, but not Ezri's first time in a combat situation, but not Dax's first time in a combat situation. So that was an interesting little conversation to talk about. Like, she remembers the feeling, but it's actually experiencing it is different than some other person's memories.
And I felt like that's a bit of foreshadowing of what happens to Nog, right? Because at the beginning, he's seeing the heroes, he's seeing sort of the glorious, more idealistic parts of the idea of fighting in a war. Mm-hmm. And by the end of the episode, he really feels in his body, right, what it means to have been part of a battle. Even though he might have been in combat situations before, it's the first time where he sees his, like, life really, really at risk and sort of bearing the scars of what it means to have been in combat.
Yeah, and one imagines, I've never been in combat, but one imagines there is a certain excitement, and because you've trained for it, and you're both terrified and excited because this is the moment I've trained for. I have a mission. I believe in the mission, and I'm going to you think about, certainly, lots of media depictions of war glorify it, and, you know, your war heroes. And I think this episode does a really good job, as you point out, of Nog kind of being really impressed with the veterans that have been down there. Like, one of the guys has a necklace that he has taken, the Ketracel white containers from each of the Jem'Hadar he's killed. And so,
which is kind of grotesque, right?
Yes, it is. And then another one has like some kind of knife that's not Starfleet regulation. And so Nog is impressed by, you know, these guys are, they're tough heroes. Like these are real people. And they do a good job of interposing that or intercutting that with Quark basically telling Nog, listen, Nog, We're not in a good situation. This is, you shouldn't be looking up to any of these people. War is hell. This is awful. We shouldn't be here. Why do you like these humans? We got to get out.
Yeah. I mean, I think the how they play Quark and Sisko off of each other in this episode in relation to Nog is really interesting, right? Because they're both father-like figures to Nog, and one is, you know, Sisko's sort of the embodiment of duty, right? No matter what the cost, the orders have to get followed, the job has to get done. And then there's Quark, who's like, think about your family, you're Ferengi before you're Starfleet. This isn't a situation that you need to be in. And Nog is sort of he finds Quark's presence there really annoying at the beginning, right? There's a scene where they get attacked on the ship, and then Quark is sort of panicking and running around, and then he ends up on the bridge after the battle is over, and then he's kind of just lingering.
He's just kind of hanging out.
He doesn't know what to do. And so, yeah, so he says, I came to say hi to Nog or something, and then Sisko's like, you said hi, now get out of here. And then right there, Nog is super embarrassed. He's like, oh, this will never happen again. But, you know, that's sort of Nog's initial choice between duty and family. And then it comes up again when he's sent out to on this like search party, right, or the scouting party, where the question comes up again. And so you can see Nog sort of placed between family and duty, and wanting to choose duty, but that has a cost for him and, you know, people around him later on.
Yes, and then so we should talk about that, because in the scouting party, Nog does discover the Jem'Hadar, and they run back, or they attempt to run back to their base, and Nog gets hit and is carried back. And one of the veterans says to Sisko, the kid did all right, even though, you know, he's unconscious and had to be dragged back. And I suppose you read that as he was brave and he did a good job. And it is really interesting to see Quark, kind of the devotion that Quark has to Nog at that. I mean, we see it throughout the episode, but it comes in stark relief when he is in the makeshift kind of sick bay area, and Bashir is trying to, you know, do whatever Bashir can do. And you know, there are a couple of scenes where Quark is just standing next to the unconscious Nog, and a very good, so I have seen this episode before, and I forgot what happened in it. So I was thinking, at a certain point, there's lots of Jem'Hadar attacking, and I thought to myself, I hope that they don't have Quark come out with a phaser rifle and start shooting Jem'Hadar soldiers, because that would just be, I think that would be, that would undermine his whole presence there and the reason why he's there and his argument, right? And they don't do that, but they do something I think that is super interesting, in that a Jem'Hadar soldier kind of shows up and is going to attack them, clearly. And Quark, being Quark, has a phaser hidden on him, and he takes it out and defends Nog and kills the Jem'Hadar. And it's not and it is clear on his face that it's not an act of bravery, but it's kind of an act of protection and desperation, right? Which,
yeah,
is right on the money for Quark. So I really like that.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask you what you thought about that scene, because it's the moment where, you know, Quark gets a bit of blood on his hands. Right? Mm-hmm. He's been saying, we don't need to be here. We don't need to be a part of this war. If it were the Ferengi, we wouldn't even be in this situation. And then when he's pushed in that moment, he turns around and he shoots a Jem'Hadar soldier, and he's killed somebody. But when he killed the soldier in that moment, it's not quite the same as the sort of more duty driven, you know, protect the outpost kind of thing that is happening outside, right? It's really an act of protection of family.
Mm-hmm.
Right? He's there to make sure that Nog gets out of the situation alive, and he's not happy. Nobody's happy about what they're having to do, but he's especially, I think, unhappy about having been thrown into that situation. But even then, you know, he does what's needed to be done in that moment.
Yeah, and I think that, and I will, and you can see on Quark's face that he is not, I mean, he did what he had to do, but he didn't like relish it, and he doesn't like take a memento or anything from it. He's just like, I am protecting Nog, and you can feel the weight of his kind of his familial duty, right? Because Rom like if he didn't protect Nog and he lives, he's had let down Rom and all of this, right? So he's like, I can't let this happen. And he doesn't. So good job, Quark. That's what I say. Also, although, you shouldn't be there anyway.
It makes enough sense that he was there in the first place.
But I guess it's good he's there, because otherwise Nog would have been killed just being unconscious. One assumes the soldier would have just killed Nog.
That's true, yeah. But if you're sent on a fact-finding mission from, was it the Grand Nagus, there were probably better places to do
fact-finding. Yeah, and I don't understand why the Grand Nagus would, like, there's nothing for the Ferengi Alliance to do in this random communications outpost. It makes very little sense.
Yeah, and wouldn't you want to keep the what's happening there a bit secret?
You would think so.
It's just like a strategically very important place, but here comes Quark, who's just a guy essentially until the Grand Nagus says go over there, and not quite clear what he's supposed to find there. But I'm sure Rom and Nog are happy he was there in the end.
I think so. And while I love Quark as a character, he's not the most trustworthy person, so I wouldn't think that he should go on a secret mission either. I'm not sure if it was a secret mission. It might just have been a resupply mission, but still, very weird. And then Nog loses his leg, what's his name? Bashir says that he might not even be able to replace it because the nerves have been damaged so badly. Although for people who have not seen the follow-up episode, they do replace his leg. Nog walks again, although he has some...
Eventually.
Exactly. But he has more scars than physical scars from this episode, which I think I really do appreciate, because this is a traumatic experience. It looks like, I mean... We know Sisko's not going to die, but there is a moment where it appears as though he may die because he is fighting some Jem'Hadar and he gets knocked unconscious. But he regains consciousness, and backup has arrived, and the Jem'Hadar have been defeated, and they go back to Deep Space Nine. But at what cost? In a good scene, Worf tells Sisko that they achieved a great victory. Sisko is not quite as enthusiastic as Worf is about this great victory.
Well, that scene with Sisko, where he sort of fades in and out of consciousness with the soldier standing over him, there's a similar scene in that movie, 1917, I think, where I think the only cut in that movie is where the soldier loses consciousness after running into some German soldiers or something. And so I'd actually watched 1917 and a bunch of other war movies that Netflix had recommended to me a few weeks before this. And it was interesting how similar, those ideas are. The tensity and the waiting and the anxiety and the trauma of being in a war. And I was thinking, why are there so many World War I movies right now? And it's about 100 years after World War I, right? And then so I started thinking, well, what was how long after big wars was this episode? And I was thinking, well, it's like almost exactly 50 years after World War II ends, and then almost 20, just about 20 after Vietnam ends. And I was thinking maybe the writers were processing some of that, like thinking about on these big anniversaries what it must have been like, or maybe even what it was like for them to be a kid in Vietnam going through all of this and waiting for an enemy that you can't ever, really see in the dark.
Yeah, and I this is thanks to Memory Alpha. I do not know this, but I know it because Memory Alpha tells me that the director was in Vietnam, and so certainly brought some of that experience, I'm sure, to the direction in this episode, and kind of gave us. I mean, this is as close to war as I want to get, frankly, watching a fictionalized version of it. I have no interest in having to deal with it in my life, because it just seems horrible. That's a very trite thing to say, but it's true. And then this episode ends as it begins, which I think is a nice little bookend of Sisko looking at the... Kira gives Sisko the list of casualties, and there's what, like 1,700 names or something like that on it. And Kira says, I wouldn't say flippantly, but maybe a little flippantly, that's a lot of names. And Sisko kind of goes off a little bit and says that they're not just names, they're people, and those people have families and all of that stuff. So we can't forget them and the sacrifices they make. And then the episode ends.
Yeah, I wonder about that too. Like, Kira's somebody who's been through a lot, a lot of fighting. Sisko has been as well, but maybe not in the very personal, immediate sort of way that Kira has. So, you know, maybe she's experiencing for the 10th time something that Sisko is maybe only experiencing for the first or second or third time. There are a lot of battle-hardened characters on Deep Space Nine.
Yes, and Kira is one of my favorite characters in Star Trek, period, just because she's so interesting. She's hardly in this episode, but I will give her props because I like the character so much. And I think you're right. Her experience informs her reaction, and one imagines if you experience such traumatic things over and over again, you have to, for your own sake, develop some calluses around your feelings and kind of deal with it as, like, you can't possibly deal with that, you know, 1700 number as 1700 actual people, like, every time, because then you would not be able to do anything, right? Because that is a horrible thing. And so as Sisko is, like, in command and sending people to their deaths, basically, as we see in this episode, you have to, well, A, one hopes you agree and truly believe in the mission that you're doing, and B, you kind of have to insulate yourself a little bit, one imagines.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's a private moment, maybe, where he's processing all of this. He might not come out and say exactly the same thing when he's among other officers.
Mm-hmm. Well, Grant, I invited you on my podcast because you wrote a very funny thing for McSweeties, and then we end up talking about one of the heaviest episodes of Star Trek, I think, that exist. Yeah.
I thought, you know, I know that it's not in scope exactly for you, but I thought, you know, Lower Decks thing might be after writing that, but maybe someday, I don't know.
Yeah, that would have been more thematically appropriate, I think. But I will say, and I think I know your answer to this, but I'll tell you what I think this is a really good episode of Star Trek, even though it is certainly atypical, but it is, I think, really good. What do you think about it?
No, I think it's brilliant. It's not the Star Trek that I started with, but it is a Star Trek. I think, you know, it sets the stage for a lot of the stuff that comes after.
Mm-hmm.
More complicated, a lot darker, and it sets up a universe that things happen in and have consequences in. So I think, you know, for all of those reasons, this is a really, really, really nice episode and a nice part of a season 7 arc.
Yes, and I'm trying to quickly look up the name. Well, you just watched the episode where then Nog has to deal with the ramifications. Yeah. What's the name of that episode? I can't remember.
Only a paper moon, or something like that.
Where he helps, with the help of Vic Fontaine, he deals with his kind of trauma. And Vic Fontaine is an interesting character, one that I didn't really like until that episode. I think he's great in that episode.
Yeah. Well, I have two things to say about that. One is that I felt like the teaser of this episode, so Rom is like auditioning to be a singer in
very
Vic's
weird
club or something.
Totally.
Like that, right?
Yeah.
That interaction, like, it actually foreshadows what happens in this later episode, right? Only a paper moon, because they say stuff about, like, I'm only a hologram, or you're not a hologram, so you can't be here.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a bit of some I wonder how much that the writers were thinking about that next episode when they were working on this one. But the other thing is, and this goes back to like a minor complaint, is why, so there's a moment right before the battle where Bashir plays Vic Fontaine's music over the loudspeakers of their compound or something, and I thought that's a really peculiar tactical decision to make in that situation.
Yeah.
I'll just leave it at that.
And I don't even know, like, it doesn't have I feel like it's supposed to have this big impact on me as a viewer, like, oh, that's the music he got at the beginning of the episode, which, by the way, why does he have to go to a hologram to hand him a physical thing of music? Couldn't he just, like, the computer create the music? But that's another thing. And it just really struck me as just weird. Like, I don't understand why you're playing this, like, 500-year-old song to kind of pump up people sung by a hologram. It's very weird.
Yeah, if I were a soldier, then I'd be like, "Who's doing that? Turn off the music right now." Turn off
the music.
Exactly. Don't you?
Exactly. I agree. Well, Grant, it was a pleasure to talk to you. So I am glad that you accepted my random email to invite you onto my podcast, and I'm doubly glad that you accepted the invitation.
Thank you for sending me a random invitation and accepting a random guest.
It was my pleasure. And maybe you'll be on again, unless I have traumatized you, a la Nog.
I'd love to come back. I hope your random number generator gives me something lighter to work with.